The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Race to savings now at Menards. We have what you need to give your bathroom a fresh, updated look. Shop Menards' great selection of bathroom products from American Standard. No matter the size of your bathroom, American Standard offers a superior line of toilets, faucets, and more. Complete your bathroom update today with American Standard. Plus, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and race to savings on more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Bonus Fridays with your red-handed fantasy life. I don't know where I was going with that. What we've got coming up for you here is an interview with Colin Sutton, the detective who put Levi Belfield behind bars. We had a great time talking to Colin. We were in a proper studio and we actually ended up having some problems with it because of the bedroom DJs that we are. But it's mainly my voice that's the problem, but the rest of it is wonderful. Saruti and Colin sound fantastic. It's a really interesting interview. So please forgive us the slight sound issues that we had. They're honestly not that bad. Enjoy the interview and we'll see you next week.
Well, hello, Red Handers. You're getting an extra episode this week. Aren't you lucky? As we promised yesterday in the Levi Belfield episode, we have a very special treat for you today because we are sat here with the man himself, not Levi Belfield, but former DCI Colin Sutton, the man who, and he hates this, manhunted Levi Belfield. I would like to say like a round of applause, but that feels strange. So we'll just say welcome, Colin.
Thank you. I feel welcome.
Yeah, welcome to this studio. We're in an actual studio this week, not in boxes in our bedrooms as usual. So we drove quite away. As did Colin. Colin beat us here because he's a detective and is better at finding places.
Yeah, we were worried because we were running late and we were like, if Colin doesn't find it, then it destroys this good man's reputation because he couldn't find this random studio that we found for him to come record in. Imagine if we had just made you come hang out in our bedrooms and record in the weird boxes we record in, Colin.
Some ways, after getting in here, I think I'd have, you know, preferred that.
Well, hopefully now that we're inside this studio, we can forget about the rather scariness outside. Maybe it's just because we're so remote and we're not used to it. I feel like I'm just used to looking at people constantly.
Thank you so much for giving us your time and for driving all the way out here. We're incredibly excited to be here.
No, I am as well. It's you know, since we bumped into each other, as it were, I've become a great fan of your work.
That's very sweet. Thank you very much. Colin's even in our Facebook group, I saw.
I am.
How did you feel about the barrage of questions that were amassed in about 24 hours after we posted that we were meeting you today?
I kind of almost regret saying I'll go back and answer them because there are quite a few there. I mean, the ones like beer or gin, I can cope with that easily, but it's the tough stuff. Like how do you cope with this? I don't know.
Wow.
I'm as weird as they are. I don't know.
Well, we're going to have a deep dive dig into that. Don't worry, because we have accumulated all of those many questions that our listeners wrote down for you.
We'll just give you the really difficult ones that will make you uncomfortable. I'm kidding. And they're going to be asking really nice questions.
Let's kick off. We have some sort of Levi Belfield-y themed questions, just because we've obviously done the research for that and we did the episode that went out yesterday for our listeners. And just a couple of things sort of stood out to us immediately when we were doing that. And please feel free to elaborate on this, anything else that you think is important and that people should know. Obviously, one of the key things with this case is that Millie Dowler, she wasn't immediately sort of with the original group of victims that Levi Belfield was tried and convicted for. When did you first link Millie Dowler's murder with Levi Belfield?
I think it's, you know, to start with your question, really, she's not in the group because he had very defined different sort of silos of offending. And one of those was trying to pick up women, young women, on the street from his car, get in, love, I'll show you a good time. And they say, no, thanks. And then he gets out and whacks them. And that's kind of what we think was that sort of crime. But he also had this interest in young teenage girls with his friends. And the sort of MO there was that he would find one, drug her, and ring his mates up and say, yes, I've got one. And that girl would end up being gang raped. So they were kind of in different areas of his offending, I suppose. As to how we first linked it, well, the ironic thing is, when we found Amélie Delagrange's property at Walton-on-Thames in the river, we were very, very keen to de-link it, to say this is nothing to do with Millie Dowler, because at that time we thought that was the case, and Surrey police wanted that sort of distinction as well. In fact, they sent along a pretty senior officer in uniform to be in the press conferences with us to say this is nothing to do with Millie Dowler, folks. What then happened was, in November 2004, I was just sitting idly glancing through a huge stack of paper, which is Levi Belfield's intelligence file, and realised that he lived in Walton-on-Thames, and looked at the map. And I thought, oh God, you know, it's literally 20 yards away from the last place that she was seen. And there's an old saying, isn't it, detectives don't like coincidences. Well, there's so much of a coincidence. You've got this guy here who we were starting to find out more and more dark, really sort of scary stuff about, and he's 20 yards away from when she goes missing. So that was kind of what, you know, first alerted me to maybe, in fact, he did have something to do with it.
And why is it, do you think, because when we've sort of been talking about covering this case for a while, people go, oh yeah, Millie Dowler. Why is it that people remember her?
Oh, I think because it's, you know, there are certain cases that are burned into people's memories, and Millie Dowler's one of them because of the circumstances of her going missing, her age, the you know, there was a huge campaign of publicity by Surrey Police. They did some very obvious and overt searching for months until she was found. It was 6 months before her body was found. We always knew that. When we'd kind of linked it together and got Surrey in with us, I always knew that if we did link them up to the same trial, it would become the Millie Dowler trial. And while that was, you know, a little bit of a disservice to my victims, I didn't actually care. I just wanted him put away, and that's the important thing. So it didn't matter. But the fact was that when we took that to the lawyers, Surrey weren't in so advanced a position as we were to go ahead with the trial. So that was sort of hived off, and we had my trial, as it were, and then Surrey followed up a few years later.
Okay. And actually, I'd love to pick up on something you said in that first point, actually, about how he had two very separate, almost MOs or silos, as you said, of offending. Mm. How common is that, to see an offender like Levi Belfield, where when we sort of read about cases, often it's that these guys have a very specific MO, they follow it, it's a fantasy, to have sort of on one hand the blitz attacks that he commits on the streets with sort of slightly older girls and women. And then I know he was sort of involved with some of the paedophile ring stuff that you also headed up on. Was it Operation, I don't know how to pronounce it, Yedis?
Yedis.
How common is that in terms of having two very different styles of attacking and two different MOs like that? Mm.
In my experience, it's not very common. And I think, you know, those who have studied sort of academically this sort of thing much more than have I would probably say the same thing. You know, we're used to offenders having a kind of a linear progression of offending and an escalating offending going up. He wasn't linear. He was kind of, I drew a slide on one of the presentations I give where his head's in the middle. And despite that, there is room for other things on the slide, although it's quite a large head. And there are sort of like wagon wheel stripes coming off, and all these different areas of offending that were discreet. And you know, these were just two of them, because he also had drug supply, he'd do fraud, he'd do enforcement for other people, domestic violence and domestic rape, you know, awful, awful things. So he was just lawless. He was just, you know, I've never come across anybody who lived their entire life in such a way where they just had complete disrespect for not only the law, but for societal niceties and the rights of other people, and especially women.
Absolutely. And I think that abnormality, as you say, with having two very different MO styles, makes it really interesting, because then when you look at the idea that there was the probe in 2016 where they felt like a lot of people were saying, because of the letters that he'd written from prison, that perhaps he'd been involved with other murders. But when you look at some of those people, I know it's the Russell murders with Lynn Russell and her daughter that a lot of people think he was responsible for. She looks completely different to his other victims. Do you think there is a possibility then for an even wider victim pool and higher numbers that we're just not even aware of because he was so erratic in his MO and victimology?
I think in terms of out and out numbers of offences, then it's, anybody's guess. I think we made as good a job as we could of making sure there weren't any outstanding murders that he might have committed. The Russell murders, I've said many times, there is a statement from his ex-girlfriend who says she knows exactly where he was with her on that day. And if that statement is correct, if her recollection is correct, and I think it was her 25th birthday or something like that, so it's kind of something she might have remembered, then there's no way he could have committed them. Absent that, I understand why people say, yeah, he's a good suspect for the Russell murders, because it kind of fits in with the things that he would do.
And what do you think drove him to do the things he did? Like, what was behind it all?
No, I've really no idea. I've no idea. I mean, he's never spoken to us. He's never even, acknowledged his guilt. So we have no idea what drove him. All we can say is that, it appeared with the offences like Amélie Delagrange, Marsha McDonald, Kate Sheedy, and some others. It was this business of pulling up alongside, hello, love, I'll show you a good time. When they say fuck off, quite rightly, as they would, that's an affront to Levi Belfield. How dare you? How dare you do that to me? And he gets out and there's the attack. That's kind of what we think was the motivation for those. But then, what's the motivation for the other, for the offences against the young girls? It's a sexual gratification, I guess, and control and power and all the other things that go into these things. But I think, essentially, and it's a very sort of rudimentary suggestion, but he just did what he wanted to do. He didn't care what the law said. He didn't care what norms said. He just did what he wanted to do.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things that you said when we actually heard you speak at that weird bar that we all met in.
Hey, man, my dog had a great time. She had the night of her life. She's a social media star now.
And in there, you said that when you sit opposite Levi Belfield, he has a dead look in his eyes.
Yeah.
Could you expand on sort of what it feels like to sit opposite? It's something that we talk a lot about true crime. We talk a lot about these offenders, but none of us and most of our listeners will never have sat across from an offender like that. What is that actually like?
No. Just on the point about the eyes, you have dark eyes, but I sit and look at them and there's a sparkle and there's a reflection.
Thanks, Colin.
And so forth. Yeah, right, but his are just coal black and matte. There's just nothing there. And he kind of has this, he has a number of sort of nervous tics. He'll sort of wobble his head about a bit. And he doesn't wobble it hard enough, probably, some would say. But he kind of does this sort of thing, and his eyes will blink occasionally. But there's nothing there. There's nothing. You're not getting anything back from his face at all when you're sitting talking to him. In terms of what it was like, I mean, in some ways, it wasn't any different from any other offender that I've sat with. Maybe it was in the sense that quite often I've sat across the table from people and felt some sort of empathy or some sort of at least understanding of why they did what they did because of the circumstances they were in or something like that. With him, I had no idea, no understanding at all of how he could do what he did. And the other thing I think that was unusual was that there was absolutely no sense of rapport with him. Even, I went on and dealt with Delroy Grant, the night stalker of South East London and the rapist. And I had a conversation with him. He was a human being who just happened to have a sideline, a very sick, violent, horrible, twisted sideline. But nevertheless, he had a normal life. Belfield didn't have a normal life. His whole life was built around upsetting others, harming others.
Like his entire life was just in the pursuit of his criminal activities.
I think it was just in the pursuit of whatever he felt he'd do next.
Do you think he saw it as criminal or necessary?
I think there's certainly evidence that after he'd committed the murders for the Met jobs, as I say, Amélie and Marsha and so forth, there's evidence that it affected him psychologically, that he realised what he'd done. And he's, you know, we had witnesses who said they were sitting in the car with him. He said, "Oh God, you don't know what I've done. You know, I've fucked my life up," and stuff like this. And he booked himself into the local sort of mental hospital, mental wing of the hospital, a couple of times. So I think it did get to him at some point, but he kind of got over it quite quickly, too quickly.
Right. There was no sense of like an inverted conscience or anything. He knew what he was doing was wrong.
No, I don't think so. I don't. And I mean, the way that he treated Amelie's parents in the courtroom, as soon as the judge and the jury were out and it didn't matter, his butter wouldn't melt and the mouth sort of facade dropped and he would be staring at them. He actually, you know, called them scum or something, or you know, actually abused them. And you sort of think, how dare you, of all people, say things like that and treat the parents of a girl that you killed, who have acted in such a sort of dignified way for the entire time?
Because there is a lot of that sort of irreverence for other people's feelings or for just the sanctity of human life throughout his long career in this. But there is also that feeling that he seems to toy with people. There's a lot of lying. There's a lot of half-truths. He never, like you said, he never admitted to anything, even though he's been served a whole-of-life sentence. What do you think is it about that? Is it about the power of holding on to his own kills for himself? Why do you think he doesn't just tell people what he did? Isn't there some satisfaction in that for him?
Well, I always thought it was something to do with his mother, because his mother had this very sort of overbearing relationship with him. And I often said, you know, once she dies, and she was very ill like 15 years ago, and she only died relatively recently in the last year or so, if she's not there, then you might find that he will come to terms with it. But, I mean, he couldn't, I don't know if I told you this story, but when he was in prison, he got sent into segregation for a week for testing positive for cannabis. They do sort of urine tests. And because he used to ring his mother every day, she's sort of thinking, where's Levi? Why hasn't he phoned me? And when he eventually got back out of the sort of solitary or whatever they call it and phoned her up, she says, where have you been? Why haven't you phoned me? And he said, oh, I got sent down the wing, mum, you know, or something, whatever they said. Oh, what was that for? And he said, oh, fighting. Somebody called me a pikey. So I had to, that's good boy, you know, defend the honour of the family. He wouldn't. His late 30s, he wouldn't tell his mother that he'd been smoking a joint in prison.
And he's a convicted murderer.
He was on remand at this time.
Oh, I see. Right.
But that was the point. He's an absolutely grown man who couldn't say to his mum, well, it's a bit boring in here. There was a bit of puff going around, so I had some, and I got caught. You know, he had to sort of twist it round so that she would see something good and something to be proud of in it. So I thought he might do something then. He might say he hasn't. I mean, all he does is he just doubles down all the time. And he kind of comes up with harebrained things. And he's very good at manipulating the media. And sort of, you know, if he's been out the headlines for a few months, he just likes to sort of do something or slot something in. But it's kind of, he, I suppose, was a narcissistic streak or was a narcissist. He had this inflated and wholly wrong opinion of himself. And he, you know, for example, when he was giving evidence in the trial, he was talking about his wheel clamping firm. And it sounded like he was kind of the chief exec of ICI or something, you know, that he was running this multi-million-pound, multinational business rather than just employing half a dozen waifs and strays from the local council stake on a tenner a day, which is what it was. But he was kind of, you know, I was a businessman. I was running a business. Well, no, you weren't, Levi. You were going around extorting money out of people who happened to have left their car, you know, in someone's car park.
Yeah, it does fit a lot with the narcissism of it, because especially when you link it to the mother, the need for admiration from her, the fact that he can't let the shame associated with that. And maybe that's why he can't confess to these things.
Yeah, I'm at the very boundary of my sort of psychological knowledge here. But that's kind of how I see it and from my experience of speaking with him, yeah.
That's fascinating. Is there anything else you think? Obviously, the Levi Belfield, we watch every single documentary that we could find about this.
I'm in most of them.
You are in most of them. And, you know, that was really fascinating to hear, because in each of them, they obviously asked different questions. I felt like it's very comprehensively covered. Is there anything about Levi Belfield, especially now, sort of more recently? Like you said, he's never out of the headlines. I just Googled Levi Belfield, put it into the news tab in Google. And as of like last week, there are stories coming up.
Yeah.
Is there anything that hasn't been said about the Levi Belfield case?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's difficult. I should have thought of this before I came to see you, shouldn't I? I don't think so. And I think really, you know, there must have been 8 or 9 documentaries done. There's been another, you know, the original book that Jeffrey Wonsell wrote. There's the book I wrote. There's an awful sort of lot there. I think one of the things that's not, is yet to come, has not been explored fully, is his association with grooming gangs, because there's no doubt that that existed. And in fact, Manhunt, the TV program, and the book to a degree have kind of helped with that, because we've had these people coming forward. And I'm in touch now with somebody who used to work for the social services in that area, and she's very keen to progress it. And, you know, there's no doubt that there were others involved in that, and those others are still out there walking the streets.
Absolutely. So that's very much an ongoing thing. Is it still Operation Yadis?
No, it isn't. I've no idea what it's called now, but I have been in touch with them.
How do you choose operation names? I have always wanted to know this.
It's in the book. You didn't read the book properly.
Right. Putting myself away.
Okay. What you do is you every year has, for murder investigation, every year has a letter. So that the year before that, for example, it was W. We don't do X because there aren't enough places beginning with X. It was W, so I had Operation Walthamstow, Whitchurch, Wormley, things like that, yeah? The following year, 2004, it was a Y year. Well, there aren't that many places in the UK in the guest tier beginning with Y.
Yeovil. It's the only one I can think of.
Yeovil, York, Yarm, I don't know, yeah. So there weren't enough, so they went to the American Geographia. And so that's how we end up with Yedis.
So kind of like storms and hurricanes, similar idea.
Yeah, it is. It is like that, yeah. I mean, you know, like the other one, Dora Grant, the Night Stalker, that was Operation Minstead. Well, Minstead's a lovely village on the edge of the New Forest. I'm sure they're delighted.
And is it the homicide department that get towns and then a different department has? Because I'm literally the only other operation name I can think of off the top of my head is Operation Fishpool, and that's nothing to do with towns.
No, I think the Met thing is always towns. It depends. I mean, I was... when I worked in West Yorkshire, I was head of intelligence up there, and it was my responsibility to allocate these names. We had a database, and my predecessor, or the DI there, had been a sailor. So we had all these sailing terms, and we were running out of it. And we I thought, what do we do? And I know Hertfordshire Police in the past did cakes, which is okay, but when you have Operation Donut and Operation Fairy, it just doesn't work, you see. So I said, we're not doing that. And I got my daughter's equine dictionary, and we had all, so we had like Operation Saddle and Bits and
Amazing.
Reins and Stirrup and things like that. That's how that went in Yorkshire at the time in the 90s. So it's just, the reason we do it is not, they're meant to be neutral and not to give any hint of what they're about. But the reason we do it is that it's kind of something snappy that sticks in people's minds. And if they've all got a number on the home system. So if you said to somebody, how are you going on Operation 74059/19? They'd look at you blankly. But
that's true.
That's
what it's done. Well, thank you. I'm sure a lot of our listeners probably didn't know that. And if they want to know more about that, they should definitely read your book, Manhunt.
There's a little bit in there about it, yeah. It's not a great exposition of operation naming, but it is mentioned how it's done.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you for that. And as you will have seen on the Facebook group, while people obviously want to know about the Levi Belfield case and the other cases that you've worked on, people just kind of really want to know what it's like to be a homicide detective and get in your head a little bit. So we have compiled some of our favourite questions that just do a bit of a deep dive into the mind of a detective, if you would indulge us.
I'll do my very best.
Okay, this is the most important question, I think.
This was the most repeat question we got.
Do you watch any detective dramas? And if so, what is the best one?
Almost all of them.
No, really?
That is not the answer I was expecting.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's a kind of professional interest now because I kind of work on them as well. So my favourite all-time best television series I've ever was The Wire.
Fair, yeah.
Yeah. And then there's a kind of a second tier where I'd put The Sopranos and Breaking Bad and The Shield.
Okay. Yeah.
If you go into Brit stuff, Prime Suspect was very good.
Mm-hmm. Love Prime Suspect.
Of the current ones, I mean, you have to suspend disbelief sometimes. And you know, working within that kind of niche of the industry, I understand now that I'm working on one at the moment that's about surveillance. And there's a limit to how many times I can say, no, we can't do that. That just couldn't happen because you need to have the story and you're trying to entertain. I think when we made Manhunt, it was very different because I wanted that to be as authentic as possible because that was the tale I was trying to tell. And I think we succeeded. I think it was really done like that and good like that. And So yes, I watch most detective things. I love Luther.
I love
Luther.
Although
I think it's a bit far-fetched.
I think Luther might be my favourite. How do you feel about detectives? Who is your favourite detective in a crime drama series that you've seen?
That's a good question. Probably nobody you've ever heard of, actually. But, I love Jack Regan and Sweeney, but that's before your time, a long time before your time. Presently, I quite like him. I can't think of his blooming name. What's his name? What's the superintendent guy in Line of Duty?
Oh, God.
Ted, no.
The Irish guy. Yeah, Ted. I don't remember what his surname is.
He's great. Ted. I like him. I loved, this is going to sound really bad, I actually really loved Life on Mars.
I was going to say Life on Mars.
And in some ways, I preferred Ashes to Ashes because it was the 80s vibe. It was when I started. Yeah. It was the music and things like that. Yeah, so... So yeah, there's lots of them. I watch most of them, and some of them are better than others.
Yeah, I love that. I did not expect you to say that you were watching them. We had the contingency questions if you said, "Oh, I absolutely don't watch them. They're incredibly frustrating." But you mentioned there that when it came to something that was based on reality, like Manhunt, you felt like it needed to stick really true to what it was. Mm. But then when it is a drama and it is fictional, it's there to entertain. How do you then feel about TV adaptations of major true crime cases? Mm. So it is based on reality. Those victims, some of them may still be alive or their families. Mm. How do you feel about them being turned into drama series?
I think it's a legitimate way of telling the story. It's no different to a documentary or to a podcast, if I dare say. You know, it's. I don't think in making Manhunt or Manhunt 2 or White House Farm or the any of these, I don't think there's... You know, it's another way of telling a story. And like it or not, people are interested in these stories. And while people are interested in those stories, then people will make drama series and documentaries and podcasts about them.
Yeah, and all three of us will still have jobs. Yeah, so that's
absolutely.
Good.
Yeah. You know, I think it needs to be done sensitively. I think it needs to be done in the way that we did it, whereby we speak not only to the victims, but also to the police officers and the other people that are involved in it and all of them and say, look, this is what we're doing. You get a mention. You get quite a nice mention, but if you don't want your name in there, we'll make something up. And what we did in Manhunt, and we'll do it again in the second, or we are doing it again in the second season, is we create a composite character. So in the first one, there was a young, dashing, rather good-looking DI there called Chris Summers, I think was the name we gave him, who was the one who was always moaning at Colin. Oh, God. It's really weird writing that because I have to refer to myself in the third person when we're doing it. It's a bit... But yeah, he was always the one moaning and making the silly suggestions. Now, everything that he said or did was done or said by somebody. But so we didn't have the problem of making people look a bit sort of antsy. We just made this composite character and then nobody's feelings are hurt. We tried really hard to do it in a way. And I think we really succeeded. I mean, there were no car chases. There were no fights. There were no gunshots. It was paced. I mean, Ed Whitmore is a genius, I think, with the writing. And he just paces things. And we just shuffle things around. I mean, there's, without giving too much away, the third episode, we've got four episodes for the next one, and we've just finished the first completed sort of draft of the third episode. And there's a piece in there, which is actually something that I did, that's a really good, you know, good piece of television, I think. And it's quite a good piece of, it's not exciting, but it's sort of tense. And Ed sort of said, it would be much better to give that to somebody else. And when I looked, I thought, God, you know, it's obvious, really. Yes, that makes the story run so much better if I don't do that.
How did you feel about that,
though? I don't mind. We're creating something, aren't we? I'm not doing it as a, you know, look at Colin, look how great Colin is. I'm doing it to tell a story as to how things are solved. You know, I said for the first one, I wanted to kind of inspire young officers, and I've had that. You know, I've had the people young. I want to be an SIO one day, and I'd, you know, all that sort of stuff. The second one, in some ways, the story is... I think more compelling than Levi Belfield, with the proviso that nobody dies, or nobody dies directly as a result of what happens. But there are an awful lot of old, mostly ladies, but some men between the ages of 68 and 93, and I'm talking dozens, who were victimised by this man. And yet, if you're outside London at the time, nobody really knows that much about it. And it's a terrible story of abuse. And somehow it was able to go on for 17 years. And, you know, it's I think it's a great story. We'll see. We'll see.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Do you have a case that was just incredibly difficult work-wise? We were talking in the car on the way here. What was the longest time you ever had to stay awake investigating a case?
Funnily enough, that's one of the ones that I've written up for this other series I was talking to you about. It was Easter 2008, and we picked up a job at about 10 o'clock on Good Friday. It's a lady called Crystal Hart, who was 22. She was pregnant. She was shot on her doorstep in Battersea one Good Friday morning, just by her neighbour's boyfriend, because they'd all fallen out, basically. And he wanted to impress his girlfriend, so he went and shot her.
Wow.
Google it. It's Crystal with a K, Hart, H-A-R-T. And we were just looking for him. We knew who it was. We were trying to find him. And I was out. I did get home. I got home at 6:30, and I had to pick Joe Brunt up again at 7:30 at Staines, which was half an hour journey. So there was no point in going to other than a doze in the chair for 10 minutes. And then I did another whole day. So I guess I was probably up and awake for 40 odd hours that day.
Wow.
You kind of got used to it. I still do sort of silly things. I do this car rally now, and I stay awake all night doing that. It doesn't bother me. I'm okay. I think there's a line actually in episode 3 of Manhunt 2 where my then wife says to me, even Margaret Thatcher had 3 hours a night or something, you know?
Oh, wow. Well, all of these TV dramas, if they do anything in terms of, obviously they have to create some fallacies in the storytelling, but if they do show one thing, it is how incredibly difficult the job of a detective is in terms of stress and strain and loss of sleep. But is there, having worked so hard and obviously getting so emotionally caught up in these cases, I assume, is there a case for you in your career that really stands out? They often say, you know, the cliche is like, there's always a case for every detective that stays with them. Which is it for you?
In terms of the amount of work and the difficulty of doing it, it would be Belfield. But some of the cases where the victims, just the circumstances were just so bloody avoidable and so senseless. I think, yeah, there's some of the younger victims. The very first murder I did once I came back down south, a guy called Christopher Donovan, I mean, it was just so utterly senseless. As him and his brother and a friend, and they're walking along, and they've got a bit, he works in a pizza shop, and they've got some pizza, I think, and we're going home for a can of beer, and they're singing Champagne Supernova, and there's a load of drunken, stroke, speed-laden kids coming from a party, same sort of age, and they have a bit of an argument. It's a Saturday night, and Christopher ends up being kicked to death. And he was 18, and you just think, you know, this is... The sad thing about it was we convicted three young men of his murder as well, and actually it's four lives that have gone. But, I mean, the kind of postscript to that is that Chris's parents, Ray and Vi, formed a trust in his name and deal with restorative justice and try to promote that in prisons and now in schools. And, you know, they've actually turned other kids' lives around, and I'm still in touch with them. And Christopher was murdered in 2001, I think it was. But they've done so much good work in his name since then, and they're just the most amazing people, because they've met, the three murderers have now been released from prison, and they've met them all and sat down and said, look, we forgive you. Get on with your life. You've still got it.
That's incredible. I'd never thought of it in the way that you just said, in that it was four lives that were gone because they went to prison for so long.
If you got, like, there was a 15-year-old, or he was 16 by the time he was convicted, a 17-year-old, wow, and a 20-year-old, who were all convicted of murder, you know. And while they didn't get the longest sentences, and they're now all out again, there's a savage black spot to have on your record,
yeah,
isn't
of course.
It? You know, yes, yeah, you know. So the way that will affect their lives and the way that affected their parents, who, you know, and just, I sat one of them, the 16-year-old, he was wanting to go into the army at 17 when he was convicted. And I just happened to sit next to his father in a traffic queue on the A3 one day, driving home when I was in the Met. And I looked at him, I know you. And he wound the window down. He was good as gold. And I said, oh, how, I won't say the name, but I said, how's your son? You know, he says, oh, he's okay. He says, he's in prison at this time. He's bearing up. He says, could be worse. He could be in Afghanistan, couldn't he? You know, and sort of smiled at me. But you kind of look at that, how the parents of the suspects, when you've got these young kids involved in murder. And I used to do something going around to schools to try and tell kids about the dangers of joint enterprise. You've probably heard about joint enterprise murder. And, you know, the fact that if you're out with your mates and one of them pulls a knife and stabs somebody and you're involved in the fighting, you can end up going to prison and your life has gone.
Joint enterprise is really interesting and, well, some people think, you know, controversial thing. There's been some cases. What do you think of it in terms of...
I don't think it should be abolished. I think you need to have that facility in the law. But I think the courts have gradually kind of made reasonably sensible decisions about kind of trying to limit it. You know, I think you've got to have, if you know that you're going out for looking for trouble, or you're going out to beat someone up and he dies, then you're fair game, aren't you?
You know? You knew why you were there, even if you weren't the one who did the stabbing.
But if you're going out for a fist fight and somebody pulls out a gun, you think, shit, I didn't know you had that. Yeah. You know.
And you talked about, you know, sort of these cases that have stuck with you that that you worked on or that you were involved with. Is there an unsolved case that sticks in your mind, whether you worked on it or not?
Yeah, Jack the Ripper. No, I haven't said that.
Sorry, Colin, you've got to go now. I've had enough.
No, not at all. There are two, really. There are two. One is one case which has absolutely fascinated me, which is I didn't work on because it's an American case, is D.B. Cooper.
Mm.
I love D.B. Cooper, and I just lap it up. But it's just a real mystery. But more seriously, I think, you know, it's no surprise. I don't suppose it'll be a surprise to anyone. I would love to see the Madeleine McCann case solved. And I'm still very frustrated, as are lots of people, that I don't think the reinvestigation, in inverted commas, has been what it could have been.
No. Dare we ask you your thoughts on the Madeleine McCann case?
From what I do know and from what I've read and what I've seen, I'm not convinced that we know what happened. And I think assumptions are made, and those assumptions were made and influenced Operation Grange, which is the Scotland Yard reinvestigation, and I don't think those assumptions should have been made. Somebody once asked me, how do you do this? How do you do cold cases? And I'd never written this down, but I kind of, if you imagine like a mind map or a flow chart with nodes, you kind of have to go back to the last node where you know something happened. And sometimes you can go down a path off of that and it comes to a dead end and you have to go back to that node. So one of the ways of looking at cold cases to look at that dead end and say, if I can unblock that, then does that open up all sorts of other paths for us? Probably works better visually than in a podcast, actually. But there we go. But I think that's kind of the thing with Madeleine McCann, is I'm not sure that they went back to the node they should have gone back to. I think they started halfway along.
And how much do you think gut instinct comes into play versus evidence? Like, is there a balance between the two, or is there one that will you trust your gut over, obviously not over evidence, but over procedure?
To a degree. I mean, to a degree, if I were asked to describe what I did, I suppose I'd say I understood people. I understood what people did and how people thought and what they did next. And it's kind of unravelling that's often the key to these things. So is that an instinct? I suppose it is, to a degree. I mean, it's a good example, isn't it, in the Belfield case, when we actually got some false information, as it turned out, from the mobile phone company as to where Emily's phone had last switched off. And when I looked at the map, I said, no, it won't be there, it'll be there. I'm going to put the divers in the river there. And my intelligence person that was working with me says, no, that's not where it is, it's over here. I said, it can't be. You can't get there. There's no access. It can't be there. It must be here. And I was stubborn, I think, is probably...
But stubborn and right.
But stubborn and right. It's great to be stubborn and right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Stubborn and wrong. Yeah,
not so great. Doesn't do so many favours for you.
So, yeah, there's a bit of gut instinct. I mean, there's... If I say SIOs, you know what that means, senior investigating officers, people who lead homicide investigations in England, Scotland, UK. SIOs fall into various categories, and some of those are there because they want to get the T-shirt, because it's a good T-shirt to show when they go for a promotion board. Some are there because they quite like the idea of it and do it to the best of their ability, as they think it should be done. And some do it because it's kind of a passion and they get involved with it and do it for too long, like I did maybe. But the trouble is that there is a murder manual. It does exist. It's a very thick sort of loose leaf book like that. And it's very easy to go through that and say, right, we need to do its first day. What does it say? You should consider, okay, consider CCTV search, consider cell phone dump, consider. And there's a list of things you should do. And in some ways, if you do all those, you'll be fine. But you'll get so bogged down, it will take so bloody long that what you need to be able to do is say, actually, we don't need that in this case. We don't need that one. We can go straight to that. And sometimes people say, talk about decision making in murder investigations. And I will always say the big decisions are not to do something, rather than the decisions to do something very often. And they're the ones you write reams about because you think you might have to explain them at the inevitable public inquiry or something. Yeah. You know?
And speaking of procedure and speaking of this murder book, throughout your career using that manual, conducting multiple homicide investigations, if there was one procedure that is in that book that you guys are taught that you could change in this country, what would that be?
Ooh. Do you know, I think, and the changes around the law that I'd quite like to make, it's not so much in the murder procedures. The procedures are there, but I say the change I'd make is a big red warning on the front saying you don't really have to do every paragraph, okay? Law-wise, I used to get frustrated with things that evidence that we'd found, good evidence, that was excluded because it was prejudicial. And I read law and I've done jurisprudence and that sort of thing, and I sort of have an idea about these things, but is there an objective truth? Is there a real truth about anything? Answer to me, yes. So if we actually find something and it's true, why shouldn't the jury be allowed to see it? I'll give you an example. We did do it in Manhunt. There's a scene in Manhunt from the TV and in the book where Belfield is under surveillance 24/7 before he's arrested, and he's out with a friend in like a tow truck, and they're in Uxbridge, and there's two 14-year-old girls, cousins, who are standing at a bus stop, and Belfield gets out and he's, oh, you look nice, and you know, I bet, are you a virgin? I bet I like virgins, and all this sort of thing. And they're kind of being, it's quite a tense scene on the TV because they're being watched by the surveillance, and they think, God, if he drags them into that van, we're off, you know, we need to do something. And then a bus comes along and they get on the bus and he calls them slags and something and gets them, drives away. And what happened was the surveillance team did the right thing and somebody peeled off, went with the bus. When the girls got off, they took their name, address, said, we want to come speak to you about that. And we had statements from them. That wasn't allowed in evidence. So we've got a man who we are saying, our case is that he uses bus stops and buses as his hunting ground to pick up women and then to murder them if they turn his advances down. And we've got evidence of him saying pretty foul things to 14-year-olds trying to pick them up at a bus stop, and we can't let the jury know that.
What made that prejudicial? Why couldn't you share that?
I think, the judge wanted, I mean, she was wonderful, the judge in the case, and she wanted to make sure it was appeal proof. She wanted to make sure that if we convicted him, it stuck, which is fine. It's her job.
Yeah.
There was an absolute blind panic at any time in that trial if there was the slightest hint of linking Levi Belfield with Millie Downer.
I see.
And I think because she went missing around a bus stop and she was that age, when we selected the jury, you had like 120 odd people in to pick the jury from. Because if you lived or had ever lived in Surrey or Middlesex, and you or your partner or spouse or son or daughter or father or mother or anybody else had ever worked for Surrey Police or the Met Police or Group 4 prisoner driving about people, then you weren't allowed to be on the jury. And that was all about stopping this leakage of the Millie Downer case into, because they thought that would just be so prejudicial.
So the point was that it was as early as the Marsha Amelie trials that people already had it linked to Millie Dowler, but just not enough evidence, and they didn't want to scupper the conviction, basically.
Okay. Oh, yeah. We'd known since, say, 2004. So Surrey had been working on it eventually. We had a little bit of a problem getting them to take it seriously, but they did eventually. Yeah, my father was a cop as well, in the 50s and 60s.
You've got three generations.
Four out of
coppers.
Five.
My grandfather's.
I had a step-grandfather who was invalided out of the Met in 1921 because he got run over by a horse-drawn tram outside Tottenham Police Station. I think he's saying, oh, listen, I've got the darkest, weirdest sense of humour you could ever come across. I'll tell you a story about that in a minute, actually. It might be an answer to a question. But, We sit down sort of family occasions and you've got Dad's swinging the lamp, it's known as in the police, or telling war stories, swinging the lamp. You've got Dad and then me. And Joe, I said, oh, for God's sake, did that really happen? Yeah, that really happened. There is absolutely no doubt that the kind of culture has moved an awful long way over the last 30, 40 years.
Well, you've got to tell us now, what's your best lamp swinger?
Oh, I've got my best story. Yeah. Do you know, the one that I come up, it's very slightly long, but you're quite like this.
Ah, ready.
It involves a craze, so that's quite good, isn't
it?
So one of the craze, now I have to remember which one it is that got murdered first. The one that got murdered first was Reggie. Not murdered, the one that died first was Reggie. And he was buried in Chingford, and I was a crime manager at Chingford at that time. And my superintendent came down to me and said, should we go to the funeral? So I said, well, I can borrow a black tie, but I'll just put some dark glasses on your raincoat. You'll be like everyone else there. And we were. So we went to sort of out at the back of the funeral, and there was the whole kind of panoply of London underworld and bits of theatre and bits of everything were there at this funeral. And when we finished, Charlie Cray, who was one of the, I think it was his older brother or younger brother? I don't know. Anyway, his brother, came up to us and this was, yeah, they're old Bill. Yeah. Officers, you see, so we took our glasses off. And like always happens, she was more senior in rank to me, but he spoke to me because he's old school and I must be in charge because I'm a man. She couldn't possibly be, could she? You know, that's just a word. I'm sure you know all about the world being like that. So I said, yes, what can I do for you? And I knew he was, Mr. Cray. He says, someone's stolen one of the floral tributes. So I said, you what? He says, there's a, and I won't say who it was, but it was a celebrity floral tribute. He said, there's an Irish fella, he's a gravedigger, and I saw him go away with it. So my superintendent says to me, I'll take the details, put it in the crime book. So I get back and I've got a very sensible old DS to investigate it. And I said, can you have a look at this? Because it won't go away, will it? So he went and arrested the gravedigger and he sat him down in the room much like this and said, right then, Mr. whatever his name was, it's been alleged you've been arrested for stealing a floral tribute from the gravesite.
I can't cope with this. No. Okay, sorry.
So I told you it was long, but it's quite, I don't understand this way. So he says, he'd no comments here, just no comments in the whole interview. And we thought, well, you know, why did he not? So this DS switches all the tapes off. He said, right then, Mr. O'Flaherty, this is the end of the interview. He said, I can't prove you stole this, so we'll treat it in the Met Police the way we do. We'll treat this as a civil dispute. And the way we deal with that is, this is Mr. Cray's name and address, and I'll be giving you yours. Thank you, you're free to go. The floral tribute ended up on the doorstep of the undertakers the next morning. Yeah, it goes on, but I won't go on for that. There is a punch, there's a second phase to it, but I won't do that now. Do that next time.
That's amazing. Wow. I mean, yeah, if somebody was going to give my name and address to the surviving Cray brother.
Yeah, not a good call.
I'd give back his flowers too.
So you mentioned that you watched quite a lot of the detective drama. Well, all of them. Did you watch Don't Fuck with Cats?
I loved it.
Did you really?
And not only did I love it, I think it's a really powerful idea. It shows how powerful amateur web detectives, web sleuths, whatever you want to call them, could be. And I think for law enforcement, it probably is a bit of a wake up because they'll say, hang on, you didn't take these people seriously at all, did you? And look, they were right. They'd kind of done it.
Well, yeah, I can imagine it's quite easy to sort of write people off as a keyboard warrior.
Yeah.
How would you even approach deciding whether, because, you know, everyone thinks if they Google their symptoms that they've got a medical degree these days. So how, it must be similar, I suppose, in some ways, in the police. How would you know to take an internet sleuth seriously or whether they were just
The sensible way of saying it would be, well, you look at it like it's just another form of communication. So it's just like another, you know, when you used to get people phoning up, now you're getting people from looking at stuff on the internet and they're saying, I've seen this, I've seen it on the internet. And there's kind of this culture shock or shift you have to take into account that there are two worlds now. There's this real world we're sitting in and then there's that one in the cloud and in the ether that people inhabit. And actually information from that can be just as useful. So yeah, and I think by and large, police forces certainly in this country are trying to get on with that. But I mean, do you know about the genealogists solving cases in the US?
Yeah, the Bearbrook.
There's a number of them, but yeah, I'm actively trying to get certain British police officers that I know to let their force get involved in trying to do something, because the problem is that everything is public access in the USA and it's relatively easy to do. But the great thing I love about that is that the people that are solving it are like middle-aged women who spend all their time doing family trees, because they've got the skills that are needed to use that information. And, you know, and so the police departments over there are getting emails in saying, you want to look at these half dozen people for that outstanding murder or that outstanding rape. Where'd that come from? But then when they look into it, it's the investigation is sound. So, yeah, so Don't Fuck with Cats. Binged it, just did it all in one go.
We both did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, you surprised me, Colin. I thought you would be like, these web sleuths, they need to chill out. What are they doing? No, it's great.
You have to be open.
You have to be open to it, yeah.
it's, yeah, exactly. You've got to be open to the way things change.
I guess linked to that, maybe a few years ago, we would have seen the rise of like what people called like the CSI effect, when people, jurors, juries, the general public went from not understanding what the hell DNA was to knowing exactly what they needed to A, cover up their crimes, but also B, we were seeing a rise of in courtrooms.
If we didn't have any forensics.
Yeah, if you didn't have forensics.
Yeah. That was what we thought on Belfield. We didn't have it. And a jury organ, we said, there'd have been DNA. Why haven't they got DNA? He'd bound to have left DNA. Why haven't they? If it was him, it'd have been DNA. Yeah.
Exactly.
You can just see these conversations going on.
What's been the impact of even more now people being more criminally savvy or forensically savvy, or at least thinking they are? What's been the impact of witnesses, jurors and potential criminals being that way?
Do you have to move with them? And as I said earlier, you know, people within the police service now are of the same generation of the people who are thinking these things and doing these things. So there's something there. You know, I've heard stories of very young in this service. My son said, oh, I found this missing kid. And I said, oh, how did you do that? And he said, well, his parents knew his password. So I did find my iPhone and we went and found where he was. Well, okay, that's not rocket science at all. But it's something, you know, it's adapting to what you see around you and what society is doing. I'm more concerned with the fact that CSI has, I say, made this expectation of scientific evidence amongst jurors. And so you actually have to physically, explicitly explain to them why you haven't got it, if you haven't. There's that. And the other thing, which I think is shameful, but we're straying off onto a whole different shameful subject, is that we are churning out thousands and thousands of graduates in forensic science every year. There are 43 police forces. I don't know what that means as to how many people there are doing CSI investigation, but it ain't thousands and thousands a year. And where do these people go? What do they do with them?
They end up as true crime podcasters, unfortunately.
Did you? Is that what you did?
I did anthropology, which is almost as useful.
No, that's all right. There's...
I did economics, which had absolutely nothing to do with anything.
Oh, my wife did economics. So MSc in economics.
Yeah, MSc. Yeah, same.
We've been talking about trying to do a podcast that people fall asleep to, and maybe...
It's economics with Sruti.
Yeah.
I've got lots of thoughts on Brexit. I won't bring it into here. We've got enough horrible things to talk about with all these murderers.
And we understand that you've been listening to our work and that the Enfield Poltergeist case was one that you listened to, which have you ever encountered anything paranormal on one of your crime scenes?
I don't think so, no. No, I listened to... I've no real interest in the paranormal other than that particular case because I went to school at the primary school right opposite where the house is. I was born within half a mile of there in Enfield. So I kind of know the story and know the place. No, I've not. The only paranormal thing that really we came across in the police was generally people dressing up in sheets in the mortuary and things like that to frighten new officers. That goes on.
Oh my God.
Or went on. It probably doesn't now because you'd probably, you know, yeah, that was quite common. You'd send the probationer to go do something with a sudden death at the mortuary and somebody else would climb in.
That's so funny.
And then of course there's a double bluff where you send somebody to do that but he doesn't know you've already put someone next, and so he's lying there waiting for the probationer and somebody taps him on the shoulder. I hope they still do it these days. I don't know that they do, but I hope they
do. I feel like they do. I feel like it's probably stepped itself up to another level if it's our generation involved. But it does make me think. I think I might have told the story on the podcast before, but you said that you were in the Hertfordshire Constabulary, is that right, for a while?
No, I lived in Hertfordshire.
You lived in Hertfordshire, okay. I don't remember, is Ampthill in Hertfordshire or in Buckinghamshire?
It's in Bedfordshire.
It's in Bedfordshire, that's the one.
Where's that?
Have you ever heard of that place, Clop Hill, in Ampthill?
Ampthill, yeah. Yes, I have heard of it, yeah.
Do you remember when we were teenagers, we used to drive up there quite a lot and do a lot of weird, creepy things, because say it's obviously like an old abandoned leper colony that's a church that's got no roof on it. There's all sorts of weird things, like people digging up the bodies to do weird things with. So they took all the headstones out and put them around the outside. Every Halloween, the police would be there because we would all go up there and they would never let anyone onto the site at Halloween. And I felt so sorry for the officers who had to come up there every Halloween and stand at the top of that mud trap.
I had my very first, I said I worked in Yorkshire. When I came back south, the Met didn't have space for me. I worked for 2 years in Surrey. And it wasn't very busy. I didn't really like it very much. But the very first time I got called out to Surrey, I got a phone call. It said, Mr. Sutton, we've got some human remains found. I said, oh, that sounds exciting. Where's that? They said, in the churchyard at... I said, what, as in a cemetery, graveyard? Yes, that's right. What do you expect? It was one of these, you know, these big sort of, you have these big sort of stone boxes on top of graves, that sort of ornate old Victorian graves. Mm-hmm. It's one of those. And actually the coffin's underneath, or should be, and it cracked at the top, and the vicar had gone out to push it back, and he was a really nice chap. He was an ex-RAF chaplain or something. He was a really, really good guy. He pushed, and he realised he could see a bone. So he pulled this piece of broken stone off, and thought, oh, there's lots of, oh, God. Oh. And of course, it's a good place to dump things, I suppose, wouldn't it be?
Yeah.
Yeah? So I get called out there. I get the local inspector, who is a lovely lady who's about 5'2". And we then get... and we then get the scenes of crime lady, who's about 5'1". And none of them can reach. So poor old SIO is the one with his head in this thing. And I'm chucking bones out like I'm a dog sort of digging, you know, to them. To, and it was when I got the third eye socket that I thought there's something gone wrong here. These are all more than 100 years old, these bones. They did some... excavations to extend the church or something, and obviously the workers had uncovered some remains, and they should have told the vicar so that he could go and put them in and say a few words, but they just we'll just move this stone and chuck them in here, because I get called out hundreds of years later.
How often do exhumations happen as part of investigations?
They're not very common. I've done the paperwork for one, but I've never actually attended it. And it was quite difficult because it was in Scotland, and there's different law from England to Scotland. This lad had been buried in Scotland. They're not very common, and then also not very pleasant, so I understand, or at least the examination afterwards. Because with the best will in the world, even if you've got the super deluxe teak hermetically sealed version rather than the kind of green wicker, they're not watertight, and things happen, and it's just not pleasant, apparently.
I bet.
Yeah.
They're exhuming the Somerton man this year, aren't they?
They are.
Are they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they finally got the permission to exhume him. So maybe, watch this space, we'll have some answers on who he was and what was going on with that. Mm. That's one of my like favourite cases in like terms of just absolute bizarreness. Actually, speaking of that, is there like a historical case? So obviously you said Madeleine McCann is the one that's like a cold case that you're interested in, but like a historical case that if you could go back and sort of investigate with modern techniques to get the answer, which one sort of takes your fancy?
I don't know. I did history A-level, but I never did anything before 1865, even for O-level or A-level. It was all modern stuff. I don't know. I've never really thought about that. I'm sorry. I've let you down. I'll have to think about that. I'll put it on the Facebook group.
Yes, exactly. They can wait for it. They can wait for it. They can wait for that one.
Do you have anything to plug, Colin, before we let you get back to your Friday afternoon?
Of course I've got loads of things to plug. The next Manhunt series, Manhunt 2, as it's imaginatively titled, I don't think has been officially announced by ITV yet, but there's enough sort of rumour about it that I can say it's likely to be, almost certainly will be, next January. We've just finished writing the third episode. Well, not finished, but we've just completed the first draft of the third episode, so there's another one to do. We've got 4 hours this time, and that's hopefully going to be filming in the summer, and there will be a book that will come out either December or January about the same time as well, which, like Manhunt 1, will be what the TV program has been based upon, but it will be a lot more detailed and a lot more sort of...
Can you tell us the case it's based on?
Yeah, it's based on the case of a guy called Delroy Grant. It was known very much as either Operation Minstead or the Night Stalker. And basically, it's a case where there was a rape of an old lady in her home in southeast London in 1992, then another one that was DNA matched in 1998. And it went on. And then when I started looking at it, and what we won't do in the TV show, but will be in the book, is that I think it started a long time before then. And I think he may have had an accomplice as well at some point in it. So it becomes quite an interesting story. So that's that. I am doing The Real Manhunter, which is going to be a series, I think, on Sky Crime Channel, which essentially are 10 programmes about cases that I did. I mean, I did quite a lot over the years because I did it for longer than most people do, and too long, really. So it's me sort of telling tales about other cases that I've done, and cases that you, unless you lived in the area, you probably don't know about, but some of them have got real sort of a good, not necessarily good stories about the investigation. Sometimes it was an open and shut case, but about the background of the people involved and about how it happened and took place. So yeah, I'm doing that, and that's actually been quite good fun, but it's been really hard work. And then I've actually got a contract for another book as well, which I've sort of started on, but will be after that, which is about three murders in the 1970s in London that I think are linked. And it might even be that there's somebody still alive that did it. So we'll look at that, but that will be later in the year. I mean, that will probably won't come out till after next year, after the other book. Yeah, so I'm quite busy. But I mean, it's not like working, is it? You know, you must know that from
not having a real job. Yes, Colin, I am quite aware.
You know,
hey, so we have a facade to maintain. Yeah. Very hardworking podcasters.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. It's just a really good example of how your life can go in really odd ways if you sort of hold your nose and jump in and take the plunge. It's been great. I meet people like you and do fun things like this. And it's much more fun doing this than sitting writing, I have to say.
I'm glad we got you out of it for the afternoon.
Exactly. Yeah. And we honestly thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy writing, producing, directing.
All singing, all dancing, Colin Sutton, it sounds
I know. Dog walking.
Exactly. Don't we all? Career to come and spend a couple of hours with us on this Friday afternoon and tell us all about all these exciting things. We like, honestly, please, you're welcome back anytime. Come tell us more. Come tell us more about your, what was it? Flagships? Lamp swings?
Lamp swingers. Lamp,
swinging the lamp. Known as swinging the lamp, yeah.
That's your podcast, Colin, if I ever heard
swinging
it.
Swinging the lamp.
Yes.
Have it. That's a good idea, isn't it? Yeah. Perhaps I might find time for that eventually.
I can't wait.
And we will leave links to Colin's books in the episode description to this show so you guys can go check it out. He's a lovely man, so go support him, go read his books, even though he hates the titles, Manhunt. And
Close to Home is what I wanted to call it.
This is your moment. There you go. So yeah, thanks guys, and we will be back as usual next week
with something that I don't know what it is yet, but we'll be back
next
week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Hey.